Hello. My name is Thomas Clark, and I'm from the University of Technology, Sydney. Originally, I hail from the UK, and I was delighted to be invited to this conference by Yuri, because in our student days, it was the French political economists and the organization theorists from France who really inspired us. The British ones had sort of lost their way a bit, and didn't really interest us very much. So we always looked to France in those days, many decades ago. I'm here to talk about corporate governance, international corporate governance, and comparative corporate governance, which I've actually been studying all my life. I was speaking to Antoine a little earlier. It was a difficult subject to study when it had no name. So when I handed my doctorate in to my professor, he said it was very interesting, but he didn't know what it was. By 1992, we'd sorted out a name for it. In a book I've just published called International Corporate Governance, A Comparative Approach with Routledge, I elaborate in detail the structures and operations and strengths and weaknesses of three main of the many corporate governance systems around the world: the Anglo-American approach, the European approach, and the approach of Asia-Pacific. And each of these systems has strengths and weaknesses, and of course they are in contest, as indeed are the regional economies in contest, in terms of competitive and strategic success. What surprises me and astonishes me is that in the last decade and a half, one of those systems has been assumed to be emerging as hegemonic, has been assumed to be almost unquestionably more efficient, and to be rightly the only system that all of the other countries of the world should adopt. And that is, of course, the Anglo-American system, which has emerged so strongly in recent years. And what I want to do this morning is focus on just a couple of the American approach to corporate governance, which is one reason why Europe should hesitate before it adopts this approach too strenuously. Europe, of course, has enough problems of its own, both economically and in terms of its governance. I'm not sure whether you would really like to adopt the problems of the Anglo-American approach too. My analysis is situated within the work of Hall and Soskus and others on varieties of capitalism, that there are different approaches to market economies, and that each is dependent on complementary institutions that are unique to those particular societies and economies. The European system is fascinating because of its institutional diversity. And I believe that there is a strength in that diversity, a capacity for differentiation and for uniqueness, which is very important in markets that are becoming more homogenized and uninspiring. There is an argument that's been ongoing for 10 years or more about whether Europe is converging with the Anglo-American system, sometimes under the rubric of globalization, and of course globalization can be translated into marketization, which can be translated into the Anglo-American approach. So whether Europe is converging towards this destiny, or whether there is a possibility for continued diversity and indeed creativity in the future, is a question of great debate. But something we have to contemplate is that if we do adopt in Europe and in the Asia-Pacific and in the rest of the world of capitalist institutions, the Anglo-American variety, then along with that we will be adopting in time a particular variety of inequality also. And the current shareholder value orientation of the Anglo-American approach has resulted in a particularly acute form of inequality, as I'll be arguing in a few moments. There are different degrees and systems of inequality in each of the different systems, but it's the Anglo-American shareholder value orientation that's produced in recent years CEO adopting an almost imperial orientation in the enterprise and in the economy. And of course, this doesn't just impact on the orientations of the CEO, it impacts upon the orientations of business, the structure of employment, the strategies companies adopt, and the ultimate political economy of the wider society. There are two excellent papers in this field, one a relatively recent paper by Englander and Kaufman, published on executive compensation and its implications, and that's also been republished in the Oxford Journal of Economic Review, and also Robert Boyer's paper, if he is still here. one of my heroes, from shareholder value to CEO power, a paper I was very happy to recently republish. So something we have to bear in mind is that this canon of shareholder value is a very recent orientation. When executives speak, and regrettably when academics speak, it's as if shareholder value has been the sole objective of business and the sole orientation of executives since the origins of industrialism, which is a monumental fallacy. Shareholder value, as I'm sure many in this room are aware, has only been with us since the early 1990s and has also been fairly localized in its origin. It was a response to the dilemmas of the political economy of the United States, this particular categorization from Bill Lozonik and Maureen O'Sullivan, who work at INSEAD and have published extensively on this subject. But really, the American economy has, as indeed all economies, gone through some difficult periods, periods of great crisis in the later 20th century. The hegemonic domination of managerial capitalism of the multinationals, the US multinationals, after the First World War, in which they were producing and marketing 60 or 70% of goods in major product areas throughout the world, began to break down in the late 60s, the 70s, early 80s. The conglomerates of America, which had developed partly because the executives felt safer in conglomerate structures, weren't able to compete with European businesses and Japanese businesses, and large parts of the American domestic economy, as well as the international economy, were seized by the Europeans and the Japanese. So the conglomerate structure of managerial capitalism became discredited, and in the 1980s we had the aggressive leverage market for corporate control with the development of junk bonds, the development of low-rated junk bonds with high returns fueled the takeover market and made companies vulnerable that did not perform in terms of the capital market. This was the era in which the famous movie Wall Street with Michael Douglas was filmed. Michael Douglas thought he was starring in a movie which would discredit elements of finance capital in the market for corporate control. In fact, he can't have without someone approaching him and saying what a wonderful film they thought it was, and it's why they became involved in investment banking. And you can look forward to the sequel. It's coming out quite soon. But the market for corporate control, although it was thought it would discipline executives and strip down conglomerates to their most valuable core activities, it didn't work ultimately. It proved to be speculative, and Michael Milken, its originator, ended in jail. After all of the protective devices, and there were many and multiple and very strong protective devices, poison pills and green mail and so forth, the phenomena was weakened and virtually disappeared. So political economists, investor activists, investment banks were looking for a new discipline for American management and hit upon shareholder value. This became the new creed that companies must release more value than their cost of capital. Executives were bought into this worldview by the promise that they too could enjoy its fruits in stock options. But when we think about shareholder value as the dominant orientation, indeed often the sole orientation of corporations, which it has become in the Anglo-American system, certainly prior to the recent enthusiasm for corporate social responsibility, it was quite nakedly so. When we think about it, we have to realize that share ownership, even through the mutual funds and pension funds, is extremely unequally distributed. This is a very unequal distribution of ownership of shares in the United States. It resembles fairly naked market systems at their most unequal. It's only shares, so in other forms of property and wealth, there might be greater distribution of wealth in the United States, but I doubt it. It is an economy based on individualism and opportunity. A few, in a very exaggerated way, many it rewards with a degree of poverty, which is extraordinary in the most affluent industrial society in the world. My fear is that shareholder value and the CEO's orientation towards their own stock options is compounding the drive towards inequality, both in the United States economy, but in any other economy where these motivations are introduced. What's happened is that an increasing proportion of total reward of all executives, certainly of the executives of the larger corporations in the United States, is now in variable pay in the form of stock options and other awards of shares. So it's now the majority of the reward structure, the remuneration. Again, this is of very recent origin. There was a paper by Kevin Murphy and Michael Jensen in the early 1990s reward executives as if they were bureaucrats. We need to incentivize them. And the hypothesis was put forward that if we aligned the interests of executives with those of shareholders through awarding executives stock options that would be released by the achievement of greater shareholder value, then you would increase the dynamism of industry. I think the way in which this hypothesis was taken up and became universal in American business and is now in danger of becoming universal worldwide shows what dangerous people economists are. It would have been an interesting theory to speculate about, but to have business adopt it so universally is quite terrifying. I met Kevin Murphy about 6 months ago, and I asked him what did he feel about the fact that his idea of his colleague of incentivizing U.S. executives had produced the opposite of its intended effect, because an argument I will be making shortly is that actually shareholders are not being represented very well in this system. It's the executives who are being represented in their orientations. And he said, Kevin Murphy said, well, we wanted to give them a bottle of wine to reward them for their efforts, and we never imagined that they would take the vineyard. I think they've taken all of the vineyards. And these are the people, the gentlemen in question. They are all gentlemen, of course. And it's amusing that, 40 years ago, it was the mafia in front of Congress, repeatedly being challenged for the integrity. It's the CEOs. They're hauled in front of Congress almost on an annual basis to try to explain why it is that they're paying themselves each hundreds of millions of dollars. They tough it out. They're probably tougher and better than the mafia were in the early days. Because the CEO has become a very central figure, and again, this is of recent origin. I know in France you do have a director general, president in your large companies, but in most countries, and most of the time, although the managing director or the chief executive has been someone of importance, there has been consideration of the executive team, of the importance of management, of the importance of employees, of the importance of how the whole thing is coordinated. This has all been lost in recent years with the ideology of the all-powerful CEO. And a lawyer from Harvard, Bebchuk, has talked about CEO pay and also here about the centrality of the CEO in some recent research. And he discovers that actually those corporations where the CEO is central tend to perform less well than corporations where the CEO is less central. So CEO centrality correlates with poorer corporate performance, even in financial and innovative measures like Tobin's Q. And actually, CEO centrality, that is the all-powerful CEO, correlates much closer to a wide range of less attractive performance outcomes, such as lower accounting profitability and awarding of CEOs larger rewards than their performance would justify. So we can see how the CEO's power rewards the CEO, but how it benefits the corporation or the economy is another issue. It is an era of the imperial CEO. Does anyone know who this is? It's not Caesar. You're American. It's for the Europeans. But anyway, it is Jack Welch. Now, Jack Welch not only ran GE, the largest electrical engineering corporation in the world, and indeed the most successful and profitable, but also he ran a CEO's factory, produced by General Electric, that went on to lead major corporations in the United States. And his thinking, his creed, his books, and now his talks, since he's retired and gone on the conference circuit, have populated the world of management thinking, probably more extensively than any other individual. He's not there describing the size of his salary, by the way, nor the size of his part of his anatomy that got him into a lot of trouble with the editor of the Harvard Business Review when she came to interview him some years ago. What we are experiencing is a regeneration of inequality. And I was quite shocked to find this quotation from Adrian Cadbury, who's been my mentor in corporate governance for the first corporate governance contemporary code in 1992 for the London Stock Exchange, and has influenced OECD and World Bank thinking, and has influenced all of the code development around the world, and was chairman later, chief executive and later chairman of Cadbury Schweppes, the largest confectionery company in the world, for 25 years. And this is him saying this, that American business interests have conspired to suborn the state, that the lesson to be drawn from the consequences of the rise of the political power of American business are universal, and that the untrammeled capacity of imperial CEOs is something to be concerned about. And he was reviewing, just a few months ago, a book by Bob Monks called Corpocracy, which has just been published. And Bob Monks is an American industrialist lawyer by background from an old industrial family, worked in Reagan's cabinet, President Reagan's cabinet, and in more recent years has become a shareholder activist in the United States and in Europe. And he does have a tendency towards enjoying being bombastic, to being polemical and controversial. But what he's basically suggesting here is that the CEOs of the major corporations in America have managed to walk off with $1 trillion, which even for him is quite an alarming statement. There has been this systematic looting of corporations by their CEOs, and how that fits with an efficient economy or a well-run governance system, I'm not sure. If we look at the evidence for this, the top 10 US highest paid CEOs, as recorded by a variety of sources, demonstrate that certainly amongst the best paid of US CEOs, the rewards are magnificent indeed, several hundred million dollars per annum. Some of these companies are well known to us, others are relatively small, but if we look at the best paid CEOs from the whole of the rest of the world, we discover that firstly their companies are much more familiar to us because they're much better known, because they're larger and many of them are more successful, but also their salaries are relatively modest. They're still large, and large in CEOs might have earned in Europe or in Australia 30 or 40 years ago, but they're smaller than the US CEOs. Indeed, the difference is very dramatic, and I'm almost embarrassed by this graphic because it just seems so unreal. But I think there is some reality there. I'd be very happy if some good empiricists could prove that it's actually not as bad as this. But in 1998, when Kevin Murphy originated the idea of stock options, academically at least, was at a seminar at LSE, he admitted that when Michael Eisner was paid $350 million by Disney, he was actually being rewarded more than all of the rewards salary of the 100 CEOs of the FTSE 100 companies. So one guy was getting as much as all of the business leaders in Britain, and you could probably say all of the business leaders in most of Europe. If you wanted to make that comparator. What's happened is an explosion of executive pay. The traditional multiplier was about 40 times. That was for most of the 20th century, that the CEO would earn about 40 times what the average worker in his employ would receive. And that kind of comparator would be traditionally, in the 20th century at least, the case in other economies, it would be between 20 and 40. In many European countries, maybe only 20 or 30 times at most. But what we've had since the early 1990s with stock options is this explosion, which did hit its peak with the NASDAQ and the New York Stock Exchange peak, and did fall a little in the post-Enron fallout, but immediately started rising again and wouldn't be far from its levels in 1999 and 2000. So it's an explosion almost out of control, and certainly government in America has not been able to control it, though it's often been condemned by presidents and Congress. The shareholders, who are excluded actually from a lot of influence in companies, even at their AGMs, have not been able to control it. And neither have the media or anyone else. And the worry is that this explosion could occur in Europe and elsewhere. It hasn't as yet, but European and British CEOs look longingly over the Atlantic and wonder whenever it might be that they could earn these kinds of salaries. It's not strictly related to performance, because profitability has only gone up slightly over these years. What has gone up is the booming share market, so it has reflected that in America. But what's very worrying is that in the same time period, there's been little, if any, improvement at all in workers' pay and employees' pay. And some colleagues in Manchester translated this into numbers. And as CEOs in the large corporations in the US have come to enjoy salaries of between $10 or $20 million per annum plus, workers' pay has been restrained at this level. And one of the first things that Congress did when the Democrats came in 2 years ago was to try to do something about the minimum wage in the United States. Of course, we could arguably be looking at the wrong comparators, because the first five people in this graph here are the CEOs, the top 10 paid US CEOs, but the next five are the people who are really earning, and that's the people managing the hedge funds. And I think in each case these are US CEOs of hedge funds too, who are earning three or four times more than the CEOs. I tell my son not to think of being anything foolish like an academic, but to do something socially useful and join a hedge fund when he graduates from university. And I'm really hoping he takes my advice. It's just extraordinary. I got this table of the Financial Times, and it was a big article on the front page. But you know, these articles are sometimes used to expose and criticise. But really, almost they're celebrating the system of massive inequality of reward, and the hedge funds and private equity in recent years have been at the forefront of this. One of the problems is, of course, that the regulators, though they exist, are non-operational often, instead of monitoring and advising, as in the case of Arthur Andersen, they were actually involved. Dick Grasso, when he was CEO of the New York Stock Exchange, you have to remember that it was the New York Stock Exchange that interpreted Sarbanes-Oxley and translated into a code in order to regulate their members. Dick got into trouble for taking a very large salary of $30 million or so, and when he got into trouble, an even larger package for him to go of, I think it was several hundred million dollars. And what had happened was that as the New York Stock Exchange had increased in its turnover, these are small organizations, stock exchanges employing just over 8, its turnover is increasing. He's seeing the exploding market capitalization of the companies listed on the stock exchange in the late 90s. He's seeing what the executives of those corporations are paying themselves. So Dick wants the same and gets it, but he gets it, unfortunately, several years later than the growth, the rise in the exchange's revenues. And here in, what year is it, 2001, he ends up taking nearly the whole of the profits of the New York Stock Exchange in his salary. Now, I thought, well, you know, that's a unique achievement, but I've just been looking at some other U.S. corporations, including a domestic airline that's just returned from Chapter 11 bankruptcy, and it was exactly the same there. The CEO demanded the whole of the profits of the company. All U.S. regulators are not in this position, and here's some fairly well-known ones like George Bush and Dick Cheney, who are on a small fraction of what Dick was claiming. And even Dick's boss, ultimately Alan Greenspan, was only paid $171,000 in this period. There's a story about Alan Greenspan that I like a lot, and that is that he went to Enron in the late 1990s to give a national annual lecture, and which he did long before Enron got into trouble and when it was regarded itself as the finest corporation in America. And he was rewarded for his brilliant lecture with a $60,000 check and a beautiful diamond-encrusted piece of gold on a plinth. He went for drinks in the boardroom, and then he put his coat on and left for his plane, and he left the check and the gold award on the boardroom table and did not take it with him. Elliot Spitzer, I thought, was in the same league, and he was the guy that tracked Dick Grasso down and also split off the investment analysts from the investment banks. Unfortunately, Elliot's got himself into trouble recently. But ultimately, Dick Grasso had to Dick Grasso had to pay the money back. So as Attorney General, Spitzer was rigorous in trying to achieve some greater ethical conduct in American corporations. Can this translate to Europe? The signs are that it is, but only very marginally and gradually. But the worry would be, and perhaps Antoine will be telling us more about this in a few moments, that you know this could accelerate at any time. These figures are from a piece of research conducted in the late 1990s, and certainly the position would be slightly different today. Greater diversion towards dividends and away from employment and investment. These are only marginal differences, but they are significant, important differences that I think have become trends in France and Germany and in many other European countries, and will continue as long as the shareholder value ideology is as powerful as it presently is. Shareholder activism in different European countries and different shareholder institutions, and some of the institutional shareholders have a more responsible attitude than others, though it is the case that even the pension funds and insurance companies have been investing in hedge funds and private equity whose aggressive market tactics have released better returns. This is a table from Robert Boyer's work. I'll just go through it very quickly. I like it so much because it reminds me of Shakespeare, who I think is a wonderful guy, and everything should be in four acts. And very quickly, the origin of the firm, the creation of the joint stock company, created this dynamic vehicle for growth in the 19th century and protection of risk through diversification. Early 20th century, very liquid markets, but by later in the 20th century, the managerial corporation had slowed down. The intervention of the capital markets through leverage buyout did not translate the U.S. managerial corporation to something more dynamic. So with that crisis, there was a search for higher returns, looking at new forms of incentivization. Shareholder value originated, trying to align interests of executives and shareholders, and a performance orientation for reward replacing concerns about ethical governance. And then the denouement, the final act, the lobbying to remove regulation, the increasingly financialized economy, looking for more and more rates of return and consistent rates of return, a booming stock market, and then difficulty in delivering these quarter by quarter increase in return, so resort to creative accounting, collusion between managers and auditors and analysts, speculative bubbles, growing and then bursting. Unfortunately, employees who've been encouraged to put their earnings, their savings into their companies, losing those, though not the executives who often got out early. I was in New York in 2001, and on the front page of the Wall Street Journal was all of the U.S. telecoms executives who'd cashed in their stock options for several hundred million dollars just before the collapse of the NASDAQ. And so it was the workers and pension funds that got hit, not so much the executives. So there was the crisis of confidence in financial markets and in corporations, which Sarbanes-Oxley was the dramatic response to. In many respects, an ineffective response. The attempts at structural reform of corporate governance in America has not worked. These reforms have been in place for some time and not succeeded. These are board independence and the audit committees and the compensation committees and so forth. Funds continue to grow in number, in frequency. This is when companies decide, well, actually, the previous statements were not reliable and need to be revised. And this is a significant part of the market now that's restating the statements. Is this system inevitable? Is globalization and marketization inevitable in its Anglo-American format. There are some indications of its strength in the promise of access to greater and more liquid international financial resources, in the intensified competition in product markets where it's assumed you've got to take the same management strategies, and in the convergence of the cost structures of firms. But we can also see that in Europe there has been a degree of commitment to divergence and to institutional complementarity, and actually that the divergence of Europe is the source of its competitiveness. No one can produce precision instruments like the Germans because they've invested for decades and generations in the skills of their employees and in their science, and in them produce fashions like high fashion like the French because they have centuries of expertise in this unique business. So there is a commercial as well as an ethical basis to the European system, rooted as it often is in social democracy. There's also worries that this system can be eroded away. It's spreading from the DAX, largest 30 companies in Germany, to others. It's clear there's an increasing orientation towards international financial markets, and it's clear that this could threaten the unique approach to diversified quality production in Europe. But I would argue that leveraging the differentiation of Europe is a better strategy for the future, that it will produce returns. And we can see that today. The German economy is exporting $1.3 trillion more than any other country in the world very successfully. Why should it be argued the German economy is weak if it can do that? I think the diversity of the rest of the world will survive as well. So there is multiple convergence taking place, but it's not just in one way. If Europe is being persuaded to become more shareholder value orientated, then certainly the Anglo-American world is coming under greater pressure to become more socially responsible. I think I'd like to leave it there with that kind of indeterminate and contested negotiation of systems as they change and respond to current conditions. Thank you.